Hey, gorgeous. If you want success on your fertility journey, you've got to have the mindset for it. It's time to kick fear, negativity, doubt, shame, jealousy, and the whole clown car of low-vibe fertility journey BS to the curb. I'm your host, Roseanne Austin, Fertility Mindset Master. Former prosecutor and recovering type A control freak perfectionist, I use the power of mindset to get pregnant naturally and have my baby boy at 43, despite years of fertility treatment failure. I help women across the globe beat the odds on their fertility journey just like I did. Get ready for a quick hit of confidence, joy, feminine badassery, and loads of hell yes for your fertility journey. It's time to get fearless, baby, fearlessly fertile. Let's do this.
Welcome to the Fearlessly Fertile Podcast, episode 269. Think Yourself to Health, a conversation with Dr. Ellen Langer. Hey, loves, I am so excited to be here with you this week because our guest this week is none other than the amazing Dr. Ellen Langer. She is a Harvard researcher. She's the first woman to be tenured in psychology at Harvard, where she's still a professor. She's got awards and recognition from coming from basically every direction. She's the author of 12 books, including an international bestseller, which is titled Mindfulness. It's just incredible. What I love about Dr. Langer is her new book, which we're going to be talking about during this interview, is called The Mindful Body: Thinking Our Way to Chronic Health. And if you haven't figured out after listening to this podcast for 269 episodes, we're all about the mind-body connection and using our power as human beings through the way that we think to create health and just freedom from dis-ease in our lives. And it's just fantastic. I mean, because look, when a Harvard researcher like Dr. Langer is talking about our ability to think ourselves to health and how we can break free from dis-ease, wise women are going to pay attention. So in this conversation with Dr. Langer, she's going to be teaching us some awesome stuff and how we can quite literally impact our health by the way that we think. I mean, the studies that she refers to in her book, which I highly recommend you go out and buy a copy, probably five copies of, to share with y'all's friends. It's just fascinating how we see consistently. I mean, she even mused in her book about whether or not it's even smart to be telling people about their chances of survival and their diagnosis. She asked a really smart question about cancer. She's like, I'm not sure what kills people. Is it the diagnosis or is it the cancer? Like, what is it, right? Because once we get these mind viruses in our head, it's like you can go one of two ways. You can say it's all doom and gloom and it's over for me. Or there are going to be really smart people out there that go, fuck yeah, I'm going for this. I am going to find my cure. I'm not going down. So it's just fascinating either way. So I really hope that you love this conversation with Dr. Ellen Langer as much as I do. So here you go. Enjoy. Well, Dr. Langer, I am so excited to have you on and have the Fearlessly Fertile Global community get to know you and your work. And I was just so delighted when I was reading your latest book, The Mindful Body. And I just said, we need to have Dr. Langer on to really begin to explain this elusive mind-body connection, because I've been trying to teach women about this for some time now. But what I love about what you bring to the table is real data showing the impact that people and women can have on their health and on their lives. So we're delighted to have you, but it would be awesome if you would start us off with just explaining what is this mind-body connection that we're talking about here?
Well, probably even before that, I should explain what mindfulness as we study it and have for the last 45 years, because people often think we're talking about meditation, and meditation is fine, but it's entirely different. Mindfulness as we study it is the simple process of noticing. Now, everybody thinks that they're mindful, that they're noticing all the time. It turns out that virtually all of us are mindless most of the time. We're not there. But the thing is that when you're not there, you don't know that you're not there. And so that's why people mistakenly think they're on top of the day. Now, people often say it's important to be in the present, and that's nice, but it's a sweet but empty instruction, because again, when you're not there, you don't know it. The way to be there, there are two ways, amount to the same thing indirectly. First is to recognize nobody knows anything. It's a hard piece for people to swallow. But since everything is always changing, everything looks different from different perspectives, we can't know for sure. So Roseanne, I often start these conversations and I might ask you, how much is 1 + 1? Because this is the thing we think we know better than anybody else. And if somebody in the street asked you, you'd be bored and make faces and you'd walk away. But tell me, how much is 1 + 1?
Well, we think it's 2.
Right. Okay. But so you read my books and so you know I'm going someplace else. Good for you. All right. 1 + 1 could be 2. But if you add 1 pile of laundry + 1 pile of laundry, 1 + 1 is 1. You add 1 wad of chewing gum + 1 wad of chewing gum, 1 + 1 is 1. You add 1 cloud + 1 cloud, 1 + 1 is 1. So in the real world, 1 + 1 doesn't equal 2 as or more often as it does. So what's the importance of that is that every time we think we can't, every time the world tells us that we must do something, we need to recognize that, you know, or answer as we would as little kids, who says so? Science only gives us probabilities. Most of the things that we do with respect to our health are based on science. You know, so you do what you do because you're told that's going to be effective. However, it's not always effective. Whatever is ineffective is not always ineffective. And we can't turn ourselves over to the medical world, which too often we do because we're taught, you know, let's say cholesterol, having high cholesterol is bad. Not for everybody, not for all time and so on. All right. All experiments can show is that if you do the exact same experiment again, you're likely to get the same findings. Not definitely. Okay. And that's translated into absolute. So it's very interesting because women start off, for many reasons we can guess at, mindful. They take the world as maybe. You know, you have 2 kids in the basement and they start fighting and Johnny says, Susie started, Susie, and you don't know. And so you have to deal with the not knowing. Women in general tend to speak more conditionally. Well, it could be, maybe, and have often been taken to task for this. You know, take a position, they're told. And all of that is mindless. All right. So what you end up with, and I'll get to mind-body unity, but what you end up with is a world where people think everything that is has to be. And the world I'm trying to make people appreciate, which is closer to the reality, is that virtually everything is mutable. Everything. Now, you know, when I'm giving these talks, I'll often ask someone in the audience, seems like a really tall guy, so let's say he's 6'5", to come on the stage and join me. So he looks silly, right? Because I am 5'3", he's 6'5". I ask him to put his hand up. I put my hand next to his. His hand is 3 inches longer. And then I just raise the question, should we do anything physical the same way? It would be ridiculous, you know, that when you're taught, let's say, how to hold a tennis racket, the person who originally decided how you should hold the tennis racket was a man. Now, let's say he was a big man, you know, should I hold it the same way? So we should take all our instruction as sort of try this, but then amend it to what works for us. So what I'm suggesting is the more different we are from the person who wrote the rules, the more important it is for us not to blindly, mindlessly follow. Okay, so now let me throw in one thing that I'm not going to make fit exactly, but I want to share it with people. I was at this horse event many years ago, and this man asked me if I'd watch his horse for him because he was going to get his horse a hot. I'm a straight A student, won that genius award, distinguished something. Oh, I know. This is crazy. Horses don't eat meat. He brought the hot dog to the horse and the horse ate it. And that's when I realized that everything I thought I knew for sure was wrong, at least some of the time. Right. So when you recognize that maybe it isn't so, you're more likely to want to do it your own way. And since your audience is made up largely of women and most of the world was put there by men, it's very important not to blindly follow the rules, the instructions, and so on. Okay, so now let me talk to you a bit about mind-body unity. This is an important part of my new book, The Mindful Body, but not the only part. I'll tell you, the book, by the way, started off as a memoir, so there are lots of personal stories in it, which, you know, I think makes it a more interesting read. But one of these stories, I was secretly married when I was very young. Okay. And then got married again for the general public when I was 19, ridiculously young.
I love that story.
We went to Paris on our honeymoon, and now I felt like I had to be all grown up. I don't know why, but the idea was if I'm married, then all of a sudden I'm sophisticated and a mature woman. We're in a restaurant in Paris. I order a mixed grill. One of the items on the mixed grill is pancreas. So I asked my then husband, which of these things is the pancreas? He points to something. I eat everything, and now comes a moment of truth. Will I be able to eat the pancreas? After all, I'm a married woman. I should be able to eat it. I start to eat it, and I literally get sick. At that moment, he starts laughing. I say, why are you laughing? He said, because that's chicken. You ate the pancreas a long time ago. All right. We can make ourselves sick, and much of this book is about how we can make ourselves well. Now, the medical world used to believe that our thoughts were irrelevant. The only way you were going to get sick was the introduction of a pathogen. Now, people come closer to what I believe, but still very far away. And they talk about a mind-body connection. Mind-body connection doesn't get you much further than a separate mind and a separate body, because you still have to answer the question, how do you get from this fuzzy thing called a thought to something material called the body? I said, but these are just words, words that probably some man put up. We don't know that. Let's say we take the mind and the body and we put them back together. It's one thing. Now, if it's one thing, what that means is wherever we put one, we're putting the other. That means that every thought we have is affecting our health. Every movement we make is affecting our thoughts, and so on. And the first study we did with this, let me just tell you briefly, we took elderly men to a retreat that we had retrofitted to 20 years earlier. So they were going to live there for a week as if they were their younger selves. They're talking about past events as if they're just unfolding. In a period of time as short as a week, their hearing improved, their vision improved, their memory, their strength, and they looked noticeably younger. So that was the first test of this mind-body unit. And, you know, the next one will be especially interesting to women, I think. But I'll just give you a couple of them, then people can read the book if they're curious. So we take these chambermaids. And the first thing we do is ask them how much exercise they get. Now, they're exercising all day long, making beds, sweeping the rooms, and so on. They didn't see that they were getting exercise. They thought exercise is what you do after work. And after work, they're just too tired. Very simple study. We take half of them, and we're going to teach them that their work is exercise. Making a bed is like working at this machine at the gym, cleaning the windows, and so on. We have two groups. One believes their work is exercise. One doesn't realize their work is exercise. We take a host of measures. One group is not eating any differently from the other. They're not working any harder. All that, as far as we can tell, is different is their mindset. They believe their work is exercise. As a result of this change in mindset, they lost weight. There was a change in waist-to-hip ratio, body mass index, and their blood pressure came down. Very compelling evidence for this mind-body unity. I'll skip to the most recent study we did, and then we can talk about lots of other things. We inflict a wound. Yeah, not a big wound, because I'm not sadistic, and even if I were, the university is not going to let me do it, right? But it's a wound, nonetheless. And people are got this wound, are sitting in front of a clock. Unbeknownst to them, the clock is rigged. For a third of the people, the clock is going twice as fast as real time. For a third of the people, it's going half as fast as real time. And for a third of the people, it's real time. The question we're asking is, does that wound heal based on how much time you think has passed or how much time has actually passed? And it turns out it's based on the clock time, your perceptions of how much time has passed. We have people in a sleep lab. They wake up, they think they got 2 hours more, less, or the amount of sleep they actually got. Biological and cognitive functions follow perceived amount of sleep. All right, so, you know, I hope your listeners get a sense of how much control this actually means we have over our bodies. Okay, ask me a question.
Yeah. I mean, I can't, like, Dr. Langer, like, I don't think this is a point that we can underscore enough, especially, like, I don't know if it's just the fertility world that may be lagging behind maybe cancer research or other things, but one of the things that, you know, I lived through as well on my own fertility journey. We were trying to conceive our son for 7 years, and I kept hearing Dr. Langer that I was old. And at the time, I mean, I'm 50 now. Yeah. And, you know, I was like, wait a second, I'm not 40 yet. I lead an otherwise healthy lifestyle. Like, there was something inside of me that was telling me this is not true. But I was like, at the time, I was a prosecutor in California. I said, I didn't go to medical school. What the hell do I know about medicine? The people in the white coats know more than me. And I went on to struggle for years because I had internalized this belief system. But when I started studying mindset and the power of it, which still felt woo-woo back then, because I was there was this internal conflict. But I ended up, my husband and I, we conceived our son naturally.
Yeah.
After years of treatment failure. I mean, we weren't sparing any expense on treatments. And I attribute this 1,000% to what I thought, not only about myself, but the process.
Well, it's interesting. I have much to say about that. But the first thing is, when you're trying to do something and you fail, what typically happens is you get depressed, then you get stressed. There's something I should be doing that I'm not doing. And my belief is that stress is actually the biggest killer. You know, in disease after disease, research on disease after disease, they find this to be true. I think it's true across the board. And what people need to understand is that stress is a psychological concept, right? You become stressed under two circumstances. First, you have to believe that something's going to happen. And second, that when it happens, it's going to be awful. In the case of not conceiving, you have to believe something is not going to happen. And if it doesn't happen, it's going to be awful. Things in and of themselves are neither good nor bad. It depends on how we frame them. Events don't cause stress. What causes stress are the views we take of events. The more mindful you are, the more potential understandings you have of events. All right. So, and, you know, I believe, again, this is without data, although everything, most of the things I say, I have decades of research behind, but I would imagine that the more stress, the less likely one is to conceive.
Oh, we know there's actual data supporting what you're saying.
So, and if they read my book, I think that they'll end up much less stressed. If they can't find it in the bookstore right away, they'll get more stressed, but then order it. And it's interesting because people think that they can predict. Okay, that's what stress is about, that I can predict this negative thing. Prediction is an illusion. You know, that scientists know, statisticians, that you can predict for the group. That's very different from predicting to the individual. Let's say I'm going to have a foul shooting contest with Michael Jordan. Sounds ridiculous, but okay. If we were to each shoot 50 baskets, it'd be better to bet on him. But if you were going to bet on just shooting one each, I don't think it would be smart to spend your whole life savings on the bet, because I sometimes make it the basket, he sometimes misses. I'll give you a different example I've used also too often. So let's say we're going to go to a Mercedes parking lot and there are 100 cars. And I say to you, okay, Roseanne, will you bet all of the money you've saved plus all your future savings that if I start the car, any car, you can pick it, car at random, if it starts, I will give you double of what that amount is. If I had it, it would be nice. However, if the car doesn't start when you turn that key, you give me all of that money. Most people would not take the bet because they know, you know, sometimes there are lemons. Even, you know, sometimes the best of us makes a mistake and so on. All right. You know, so you can predict to the group. You can't predict to the end. And all we really care is basically what's going to happen to me. I mean, it's very nice if you tell me this surgery is effective, or this pill, fertility pill, whatever it is effective for 90% of the people who take it. Does that mean it's going to be effective for me? We don't know. All right. Now, it's very important for people to understand that they can't predict when they're trying to decide to take some big action. If you want to decide, and these people mindlessly, forgive me, decided they need to have children, behind that is the prediction that my life is going to be better if I have children than if I don't have children, by a lot. All right. There is no way to know that, you know, you can't. And the only way to know that would be is if you have a life without children, we erase what that was, then you have a life with children and make the comparison. You can't know. And so I think people would become less stressed in the whole process of trying to conceive by realizing, you know, I mean, maybe it's for the best. And that's a hard one if all your life, you know, it's like a little kid, all his or her life, they wanted to be a doctor. When you're 12 years old, 20 years old, you have no idea what it's like to be a doctor. You have no idea, you didn't know before when you were being an attorney, you know, what it would be like running a successful podcast. We can't predict. Now, so that makes it a little crazy about making decisions, because decisions are based on predictions, right? Even if it's a simple thing, should I have an apple or a pear? the only thing I have to go on is a prediction that this pear is going to taste like the last pear I had. My body is completely different at this point, even if I just had the pear yesterday. The pear is a different pear. It grew up at a different time than the other pair, and so on. So you don't know. All decisions are, in fact, exercises in guesses. Now, people think to make a decision, what you're supposed to do is a cost-benefit analysis. You know, there are more good things for this alternative than for that alternative. Everything cuts multiple ways. The more mindful you are, the more advantages and disadvantages you can find to anything. So I say to you, do you want to meet my friend Susie? She's very impulsive. Why would I want to meet her? If I say to you, do you want to meet my friend Susie? She's very spontaneous. Yeah, I want to meet her. Well, spontaneous and impulsive are the same thing. Do you want to meet my friend Karen? She's very inconsistent. No. Do you want to meet my friend Karen? She's very flexible. All flexible is inconsistent by, you know, from another perspective. Okay. And so when we see that whatever happens can be understood in so many different ways, several things take place. The first is, let me give you the bottom line, because this is maybe it's so different from the way people think. Reading it would make it clearer to them. But I'm suggesting it's foolish to waste your time trying to make the right decision. Instead, what you can do, randomly choose, and then make the decision work for you. Make the decision right. So I did this with an advanced decision-making class I was teaching at Harvard. And I said to the students, don't make any decisions this week. You know, flip a coin, take whatever the first alternative that occurs to you, use whatever rule of thumb you want, but no decisions. So they spend the week, they come back. What a stress-free week it was. All right. You know, it's right now people kill themselves to get what they think is good. They kill themselves to avoid what they think is bad. When you know it's not good or bad, that whole thing is in your mind then. So for me, Roseanne, if we go out to lunch and the food is wonderful, wonderful. If we go out to lunch and the food is awful, wonderful. Why wonderful? Because I'll pay more attention to our conversation than the food, and I'll probably eat less. All right. So, you know, living with me is, because it's so easy, I think becomes hard because I don't care. I'm going to enjoy whatever I'm doing.
And how dare you, Dr. Langer?
Yeah,
how dare you?
So it, once people recognize that outcomes are in their heads, the more mindful they are, the more ways they have to understand and appreciate those outcomes, everything becomes less stressful. I would imagine the lovemaking improves. And if you're having more fun in bed, it's good whether or not you end up conceived.
Yeah.
To go back to that original point that they should not be so sure that their world is going to be less than perfect if you don't conceive.
Yeah,
I want to tell you, I'm going to interrupt one more time.
So, oh, no, please.
Okay. I can't help myself. I get so excited.
I love the excitement.
Okay. So many years ago, and I don't have children, I have a stepson now, but I thought, you know, somebody said, well, why don't you adopt? And I thought, you know, I want a little me. I don't want to adopt. It felt like I wouldn't get as close to the child as I would if I gave birth to. Then I got a dog. I love that dog. And, you know, when you speak to a vet, the vet talks to you as if you're the dog's mother. I mean, and then I realized, you know, well, if I could be this close to this dog, chances are I could be this close to a child who, you know, that I didn't give birth to. Okay, enough said about that.
But I love that because it's really interesting because I come across this all the time is, part of the chaos that starts to unravel in a woman's life when she starts to struggle with fertility is, oh my gosh, like I've done all these things and my life is going to be incomplete. Like it's truly this story that they're running around with.
Right.
They also, like, I think, you know, it's International Women's Day today, and it's certainly an interesting time to be having this conversation. But a lot of the women that I come across are, they're stuck in a paradigm, Dr. Langer, in order for me to be successful, I have to check all of these boxes. And I've never once asked why I'm checking the boxes.
Yeah, exactly. Who put the boxes there is the question I'm trying to get people to raise.
Exactly.
I'll give you a simple example that may be too far afield, but I'll say it anyway. So I'm a tennis player, you know, strong intermediate, nothing great. And, you know, I play tennis and I'm doubles, and I throw the ball up and I kill it. Doesn't go in. Now I have a wuss second serve, so I don't double fold. Then I ask myself, who decided that there should be two serves? It didn't come down from the heavens. Nothing that is was handed down. They're all decisions. And remember, for it to be a decision means there was uncertainty, which means it could have been different. So when you play tennis with me, if you ever do play, we play with three serves. The first one I kill, doesn't go in. The second one I kill, and it's better because I've learned from the first one, and then I still have my follow-up serve. Everything that exists was once a decision. So, you know, this tall man at 6'5 and I would be using the same toilet seat, not at the same time, right? If I'm 5'3 and he's 6'5, one of our biological needs is not being met. Nobody thinks about the size, the height of the toilet, the height of the chair. You know, you go into most kitchens and yeah, I can't reach those things on the top. And so as I try to reach them, things break. And then I foolishly, when I was younger, would say, you know, why am I so clumsy? I'm not clumsy. I'm just shorter than the person thought I should be who decided how high the shelves should be. It's a very different thought from the one that we all grow up with, to recognize that everything that is can be other. Every time something doesn't work for you, there's nothing wrong with you. It was created by somebody different from you. So recreate it.
It's such an important point that you're bringing up, because so many women on this journey, they will absolutely dive into statistics and completely live by statistics.
Yeah, without understanding that, you know, statistics can only get you so far. Now, statistics themselves, somebody has decided the database. And if this may be too complicated, let me see if I can make it easy. Let's say we're going to give the awards to the A students. Okay. And that feels objective. But it's not, because who decided the questions that the students were going to be asked in the first place that then led to the A? So you change the questions. Sometimes you change who gets the A's and who gets the B's. What I'm saying is that, okay, I have a little song that I wrote for my grandkids. And to me, it's really important. I'm going to tell you the genesis of it first. We were having an enormous amount of furniture delivered to be stored in the basement, large basement. I look at the truck, I look at the fracture. There's no way in hell that this is going to fit in that space. Now, remember, I have all these awards, you know, recognized genius. The person who's going to be putting them away is a man who often doesn't show up for work, you know, lives, you know, paycheck to paycheck, if he ever gets a paycheck, is missing most of his teeth, is someone who's depressed, thinks, you know, nothing of himself, right? So we have the winner and this person who would consider himself a loser, not I. He puts all the furniture in this space so that you can get to each and every piece, not just that it all goes in, but it's all accessible. And at that moment, when I saw that, all of a sudden, it's not fair. It's not fair. He was able to do it. I wasn't. I'm given all this. Okay, so then I write this song for my grandkids. I'm not going to sing it to you, but it's to the tune of the old Sara Lee commercial. All right. Everybody doesn't know something. Everybody knows something else. Everybody can't do something. Everybody can do something else. And so what you need to realize first is, if you can't do something, so what? You can do something else, right? If you can't do something, learn how to do it. Now, people say, yeah, it's going to take forever, but people need to understand that they don't want perfect success. They think they do. So two examples. Let's say you're a golfer and, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if I could get a hole in one every time I swung the golf club? No, there's no game there. And how do you know there's no game? Imagine you're a little kid and you want to press that elevator button and you can't reach it. And so your mother or your father, whoever you're with, picks you up and you press. And the next year, whatever, you're in there and you still can't reach the pitch. Now, the following year, you're tall enough. You walk in that elevator, you press that button. Good. After that, when was the last time you were excited about pressing an elevator button? So we can do things either imperfectly, mindfully, or perfectly mindlessly. So we don't want perfection, right? It's the journey towards it that's exciting.
You know, Dr. Langer, what do you think it is that has people resist this idea, though? Because what you're talking about is license and agency. What you're talking about
Well, okay, it's what leads people to resist that is when they're told what the standards for excellence are, we mindlessly accept it. We don't say, who said so? You know, I mean, why is it this rather than that? And so on. And when were those standards established? I had been listening, which I never do, but this is many years ago, to this conservative radio program out of curiosity. And they were, the question that was raised to the audience was, should women be allowed to be firemen, fire people, whatever we call them then? And, you know, so I was expecting them to give all the, you know, reasons why they shouldn't be. And instead, you know, they said, if women can pass the test, they should be allowed to. Again, not realizing who decided what should be on that test. Now, it's not just that, but these decisions are made at one point in time, but things change. So in the distant past, it was probably important for someone to be tall. With all the machinery that we have now, and even in the past, you know, you imagine during 9/11, you know, when everything is tumbling, that there were probably some people in spaces where that big guy couldn't get in. But yet, a thin little girl would have been able to, and to give them food and water until the cranes could, you know, and so on. Anyway, the point that I'm suggesting is that whenever you're deciding can you or can't you, you need to decide who decided what excellence is. Now, we went through a thing back, I guess it was in the 60s, when finally blacks came up with, you know, black is beautiful. Of course, black is beautiful. Why should somebody, you know, short is beautiful, tall is beautiful. Everything is potentially beautiful. And you know that I deal with this in the mindful body when I talk about the normal distribution. You know, this is what we've all bought into. No matter what the thing is, some of us, we're spectacular. Some of us, we're so awful. And most of us are middling. And then this culture does things that I strenuously object to. For the people who are wonderful at it, they give them a name like super tasters, super smellers, super whatever, which suggests it's a category that you can never get into, which of course we can't know. And the same thing with people who can't on the other end, we give them a name that makes it seem that they're stuck in that spot. And what I'm saying is there's no reason as you who wanted to have a child, was told you were too old, all of this nonsense on a normal distribution, you know, people who are this old don't end up having children, people here, you know, and so on, that you just went forward anyway. And so I guess what I'm saying here is that no matter where you fit on that distribution, there's another distribution on which you can be, you know, the best. And it's also the case that even on the socially constructed, you know, how good are you dimension, there's always a way to move past it. So first, the first thing is try to do whatever it is you think you're supposed to be doing, and you know, and you'll probably figure it out, or change the whole game, because all of it was, again, just somebody's idea way back when as to how to do it.
I love that. You know, and in that same section of your book where you were talking about this, you're also talking about lack and scarcity, which I would love to get into here, because this specific journey, fertility, is laden, Dr. Langer, with this lack and scarcity mentality. Like, there's only so many babies, I only have so much time, and it just creates this either-or scenario
for
women that I think is, it's, you know, and when I talk to women all over the world, they think that, oh, well, I can't work on my mindset because the doctor told me I only had a 10% chance. It's like, what do those two things have to do with each other? Yeah. And why wouldn't you be focusing on the way you think if you're being given such a small chance? You think you want to leverage that to the best of your ability.
The notion of probability or likelihood, you know, needs to be unpacked. So when I was, this was many years ago, and I was up for tenure, and that was a time when getting tenure at Harvard was nobody's going to get it. And I got offered a job at Stanford, and the person who was trying to persuade me said, Ellen, what is the likelihood? They've never hired a woman. Okay, so 0%. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because that's only one way to look at the problem. If we said, what is the likelihood that somebody from the East Coast is going to get tenure? You look all through Harvard, and you know the numbers are quite different. You could say, what is the likelihood of somebody getting brown hair? I could use my own history and say, how many times that I've wanted something, was I able to get it? Each of these different ways of framing the situation gives you a different percentage. So if I said that of the things that I really wanted and strive for, I'm in the 90%. If I do that, then I'm going to stick around and see what ends up happening. If I say, you know, by the status quo, and I say, well, you know, I am a woman, there's never been a woman in psychology, so I guess the probability is zero, and then I shouldn't wait around. So whenever you're trying to assess how likely something is for you, you choose your own base rate, you choose your own experience, and then recognize that, as I said earlier, and this is hard for people to understand, it's still a best guess, you know, in that you think you want this thing, you can't know. There's no way to know. But no matter what you do end up with in this life, you can make it work for you. You know, there's so many popular songs, if I'm not with the one I love the one I'm with, you know, that it's so much easier than people think to enjoy what it is you have and what you're doing. Now, if let's say, you know, all you need to do actively notice things about it. You want to be friends with somebody. I can't really stand this person. Okay. But you start noticing very easy. The more you notice, the more you end up liking the thing you notice. Now, with respect to people, you know I could get that promotion or the doctor would treat me differently. But, you know, if only I didn't think he was so obnoxious. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, you know, today I'm going to be bigoted, obnoxious, clumsy, whatever we're accusing people of, right? Behavior from the actor's perspective makes sense or else the actor wouldn't do it. So, and this is very important because, let's say, for example, I'm very gullible, which I am. Now, I can try to not be gullible, but since when I'm being gullible, it's not because I value being gullible. You have to ask, what is it that I'm doing from my perspective when, you know, you're evaluating me or I'm evaluating me negatively, looking back at my behavior? Turns out it's because I'm trusting. Okay, so this is a hard one, but every single behavior that we see as negative has an equally strong but positively balanced alternative. So we took 100, 200 of these behavior descriptions and we gave them to people. And we said, you know, put an excellent mark off those things about yourself that you keep trying to change and you keep failing. So for me, being gullible, being impulsive, I won't tell you any of the others. Now, I turn the page over and in a mixed up order are the positive versions of these words. Now the question to participants is, circle those things you really value about yourself. Well, you know why I have trouble not being gullible? Because I really value being trusting. The reason I have trouble not being impulsive is because I really value being spontaneous. You might see yourself as inconsistent. That's because you value being flexible. I might see myself as boring. That's because I value being consistent. All right. So now imagine your relationships, you know, that rather than trying to get this person to be less inconsistent, because going forward, he or she isn't saying, you know, today I'm going to be inconsistent. Oh, there I was. They're being flexible. So what you need to do then, if you wanted to get this person who you see as inconsistent to stop being inconsistent, is to get them to no longer value being flexible. And chances are you won't want to do that. You want me to be less gullible? Get me to stop valuing being trusting. All right. So what happens is when we interact with people, and that sets up a world where, you know, you come home at the end of the day and most people have a lot of struggles and so on, is because of the mindless way they're understanding everything that's unfolding. You know, it's so, and two ways that I've already said, but let me underscore them. First, you're seeing this behavior, this person who's annoying you, as if they're intentionally trying to annoy you, rather than that behavior can be understood in a way that both of you value. And I've forgotten the next, so let's just go on.
Yeah, no, I think it's really cool. I mean, because we're combining, hey, questioning these rules, questioning the assumptions, where are these things coming from, and understanding that, hey, you could fall anywhere.
Yeah, well, you know, spectrum. So be a child again and say, who says so?
Yeah.
And, you know,
Oh, no, I was going to ask you about, you know, because a lot of women get stuck in this idea that it's this false choice. Like like you were talking about earlier, these probabilities. Well, I'm not going to waste my time working on mindset when I can go do IVF and be pregnant next month. You know, it's like, wait a second, why is it an either or scenario?
Yeah.
And why wouldn't you leverage your own
Because it doesn't occur to people, you know. Yeah. So, and it's not just about mindsets, it's being mindful. Mm-hmm. I better to translate that because it goes across more areas of your life. You go into an ice cream store and, you know, you see the flavors. So somebody is telling you those are the flavors. Then they're telling you if you have, you know, you can have one scoop or two scoops. You know, everything is dictated. For me, if I can't decide if I want chocolate chip or coffee ice cream, I'm going to ask them to give me chocolate chip and coffee. But, you know, they'll say they can give me two scoops, one flavor. And I say, why? Take the scooper, give me a half of whichever one you choose first, and finish it with the other. That everything was just a decision, which means before that point, it was uncertain.
Yeah. And I think it's the uncertainty too, that people struggle with. It's
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because what I'm here to tell people is that there is enormous power in uncertainty and that all of the certainty is mindless. As with one in one can only be two. Horses don't eat meat. You know, you can't have a conceive when you're 40 years old. I mean, it's all a guess. And so, when you recognize that uncertainty is inherent in everything and that the person who's acting like they know, you know, is misguided and mindless, you become very powerful in the face of that. Even if the ice cream guy doesn't end up conceding and giving me the two scoops, I know at the end of the day, he feels ridiculous.
I bet he does, Dr. Langer. I mean, I can't imagine that you wouldn't be persuasive in that scenario.
Only because, you know, I recognize that there's an advantage to whatever they're not offering, an advantage for them as well.
And what we're talking about is really getting beyond the matrix in a lot of ways. There's this
creating it for ourselves. That's why I say that the more different you are from the people who created it. Look, you know, I have a mindfulness scale and, you know, it's good. It's far from perfect. Surely, why would I create a scale where I perform poorly on it? So the more like me you are, the better you're going to do on this. You know,
I love that. Well, and in your book, you also talk about this very real impact that we see on our bodies. Like you were talking about the diabetes, like when people have a label attached to them, you know, it was the right on the border. I think it was the
The borderline effect. Yeah, this is very important. And I think maybe easiest for people to understand. So you have a donut in the house. The box says on, you know, so it's Monday, and the box says on Tuesday, whatever date is, it's no longer good for you. It's expired. Well, that means if I have the donut at 11:59 on Monday, it's okay to eat it. But 1 minute later, when it's now Tuesday, it's not good to eat it. You know, I mean, which is, of course, silly, you know, that there's always a point where where the two categories, where you can't and you can, are so close as to lead us to question the sense of it. But let me make this better and more understandable to people. Let's say you and I take an IQ test and you get a 70. A 70 puts you in the normal range. I get a 69. That means I'm cognitively challenged. I'm no longer normal. Now, the difference between 69 and 70 is like that 1 minute, 11:59 and 12. I mean, you know, I could have sneezed when I was answering a question and read it wrong, you know, turned away for it and been startled. No meaningful difference. However, so point one, there's no meaningful difference between, let's say, 69 and 70. 3 months out, there'll probably be a very big difference. Because now that you see yourself, or myself, I see myself as mentally challenged, I'm not going to engage in lots of tasks. I'm not going to better myself. I'm going to opt out of all sorts of things. And after a while, you know, if you're told you have a learning disability, you're not going to put yourself in positions to learn. So you have the disability, I don't, you know, I'm learning, you're not. I mean, it's, you know, it's very, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now, when we bring this to the medical world, that before you get a diagnosis, there are many tests that are taken. And so let's say there's some complicated algorithm they're using, but it amounts to you get a 70, so you don't have the disease. I get a 69, I have the disease. There's no difference between us, but over time, and we've done this with diabetes and I started with cancer, and it's hard to do these studies, but it would be true for everything. Now, as soon as you get that one of us has made ourselves, that we start off the same, one of us has made ourselves sick and the other hasn't, starts to show you how much control you have over this. Just as I made myself sick thinking I was eating pancreas.
Yeah, we see this in women, especially on this journey, the difference between 39 years of age and 40. They get terrorized. You know, they see their 40th birthday looming 6 months away as if they're going to an execution. Like it's,
well, if most of your listeners are of that age, let me tell them, it gets better and better. And what happens with, as you get older, you know, there's more opportunity for everything to go wrong or everything to go right, but so be it. You tend, not always, but you tend to become less physically fit. You know, so at 90, you're not going to be able to run as fast probably, you know, as you can at your age at 50 or that you could have at 25. But who cares? You know, what happens is that it becomes so freeing. You know, when I was an up and coming, whatever that means, and let's say you and I had that lunch and I got a little spaghetti sauce on my shirt, it would drive me crazy. I'd be like this or like this, you know, all day long. So nobody would know. You know, ridiculous. And, you know, without realizing that if people know you, they know you don't typically have spaghetti sauce or, you know, on your shirt. And if they don't know you, what do you care? And so you just, you know, it is what it is. That when you recognize, there's something else I spent a lot of time in the book where I talk about level 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah. That's so good.
And, you know, and the level 3 looks just like the level 1. And the point is that no matter what you do, there's somebody who can take you apart with it because they're seeing it one way when you meant it another way. Or they can see you as glorious. It almost has nothing to do with you. It's all dependent on them. All the awards you're winning, you know, are you're winning because it makes somebody who discovered you, you know, important. So the 3 levels, let me give you, let's see, an example. Let's say a woman drops her cane, an old woman. So the level 1 who gives a damn, self-centered, you know, doesn't do anything. Bad. They should help, right? Level 2 rushes in and helps a person. Level 3 probably looks more like level 1. They don't rush in because they know that this person is going to feel better if she can figure out how to manage and get her cane herself. All right. Mm. So level 1 and 3 look the same, but they're very different. Right.
Right. The perspective, you know, behind it is different.
Exactly. Exactly. And so if we assume that every time again, we see something negative, that maybe there's this higher understanding of it, even if there isn't, you know, so let's say you see a person drops her cane, person doesn't help. You could leave it at that and think negative thoughts of them. That's what most people would do. Or if you said to yourself, what is an advantage for that woman who dropped the cane for this person not helping? You end up growing, even if it was the person just didn't give a damn about anybody but him or herself.
You know, this is just fascinating, Dr. Langer, because so often when we challenge the narrative like you are and really encouraging people to think critically and ask, like, why do I believe what I believe?
Yeah, people tend not even to realize they have a choice.
Right, yeah. Right. And then if, you know, they think, oh, that's just delusional, you know, the doctor's already told you this, or, you know, you've already been trying.
Doctors can't know. And I gave a lecture yesterday to a bunch of doctors, a lot of doctors, and they know they don't know.
Oh, that must have been fascinating.
They can't know for sure because all of the data that are in their textbooks teaching them are just probabilities. Probabilities mean their best guesses. Now, I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't respect, you know, the medical profession, but what we need to do is when you know how much they don't know, because it's too much for anyone to know, then we don't just hand ourselves over. And there's something that I talk about towards the end of the book that might be fun to share with people. It's a way to essentially cure yourself of some very big diseases while you're waiting for the medical world to, you know, to tell you what you have, of course, it's likely to take. So he called this attention to symptom variability. Now, when you're given a diagnosis of a chronic illness, the way people understand that is that there's nothing that can be done about it. And all it really means is that the medical world hasn't figured out what you can do about it. Okay. So when you have this dread diagnosis, you imagine that the symptoms you have are going to stay the same or just get worse. But nothing only moves in one direction. You know, when the stock market is breaking all sorts of records, it doesn't go up in a straight line. It goes up, then goes down a little bit, then it goes up, goes down, and so on. The key to health is often in recognizing that change and asking why it happened. Let me give an example. Let's say you're suffering back pain. Oh no, let's say you're suffering stress. You think you're stressed all the time. No one is anything all the time. No one is in pain all the time, whatever. So I call you periodically. So how are you right now, Roseanne? You're more or less stressed than the last time, more or less pain, doesn't matter. And why? Now, that why question is crucial because then you go on a mindful search for why. Why now am I a little better than I was right before? Is it something I ate, the way I'm sitting, who I'm interacting with? You know, is it my thoughts? You know, and so on. That mindfulness, and I have 45 years of research, is itself good for your health. When you're being mindful, the neurons are firing, and we find that it's literally and figuratively in life. Okay, so now, by this very simple process of looking for when the symptom is better, when it's worse, asking why, several things happen. The first, now you don't feel so helpless while the medical world is trying to figure out how to help your condition. Second, when you start to notice the change, you see, yeah, well, that feels good. I, Roseanne, am not stressed all the time. Third, when you're looking for why now, in this stress case, you are better or worse than before, you're being mindful, the neurons are firing, that's good for your health. And finally, I believe that you're more likely to find a solution if you're looking for one. So you thought you were stressed all the time. Now you're doing this attention to the variability of how stressed you are, and you discover, you know, you're really only stressed when you're speaking to Ellen Lang. It's very simple. Don't speak to me. And then the stress goes away. All right. And what we did was with diseases such as multiple sclerosis, arthritis, chronic pain, Parkinson's, you know, real biggies, we'll call them, that when we do this attention to symptom variability, we get a remarkable decrease in any of the symptoms. People end up with.
You know, now, I love that, Dr. Langer, because it's about curiosity. It's about being curious rather than immediately condemning what's going on.
Yeah, but mindfulness is a little, you know, that's smart of you, but still not quite right, because curiosity is typically understood as there is this solution. I'm curious to it, but when I get it, you know, so it's like an example is if you're drinking hot chocolate and you spill a little on the newspaper, not spaghetti sauce, could be either one. And you say, is that an R or is that an N? You know, you're curious, but you deeply believe it is one or the other. When you're mindful, things are, you know, are forever revealing themselves. Everything in some sense is new. So it's sort of curiosity on steroids, perhaps. But the point of the attention to symptom variability is that we can do this for ourselves. You don't need somebody calling. All you need to do is have a smartphone. You don't have one, buy one, rent one, or take one from, you know, somebody you know. And you set it to ring in an hour. And it rings. And you ask yourself, how am I now? Is it better or worse than before? And why? Then set it to ring 2 hours and 10 minutes. Just vary the time. And you do this over the course of a week, 2 weeks. Wonderful things happen. And again, even if the wonderful things on their own don't happen, you're being more mindful, so you're feeling more engaged in the world, more enlivened, and less helpless because you're doing something. And doing something tends to make us feel better than doing nothing when we think we could be doing something.
Yeah, I love that, Dr. Langer. And there's two more things that I wanted to ask you before we wrap up. There was something that you had written in your book about how our cells are listening. like everything that, you know, we're thinking, like,
it's That's what I mean by mind body unity. You know, that I'm not suggesting that there's nothing going on internally. What I'm suggesting is that what's going on internally is happening sort of all at once. And, you know, you bring up something, Roseanne, that I just realized the other day, so it's not in the book, about, you know, we talk about mind-body unity, which people, you know, need to understand, because then wherever your thoughts are, so too will your body. The other part of this is people don't even realize there's body unity. Okay, so when you're out there exercising your, you know, your biceps, you're also affecting your stomach, your lymph nodes, your vision, everything. And, you know, so that means that when you have one of these chronic illnesses and you don't know what to do for yourself, anything you do for yourself is doing it, you know, in a sense, for all of you. So when they said there was no cure for COVID, well, maybe yes, maybe no. Even then, you know, I had the image of an Olympic athlete and a couch potato. And they both have, you know, are exposed to COVID. First, I think the Olympic athlete is going to be less likely to get it. But let's say both of them get it. No two people experience anything the same way. And I would bet that the Olympic athlete is going to have an entirely different experience. If they get COVID at all, it will, you know, soon leave. I'm still a COVID virgin, so I, you know, can only tell you this from the outside.
So glad to hear that. So glad to hear that you were spared. You know, and there was something.
No, Roseanne, I wasn't spared. I take care of myself by being mindful. Right?
That's right.
Now, we don't know. We could do an experiment. We take, you know, 50 people and, you know, we make one group mindful and not the other group, and we expose them all to COVID. And then we see, you know, because what I'm suggesting is the mindful group is going to be less likely to get it, but I can't say that for sure. And that if they get it, they're going to have an easier time with it. But the thing that people can take away from this without those data having been collected is that your whole body is a whole body, and taking care of any part of it has to help every other part.
Also,
there's something, you know, there's some data. This doesn't come from my lab. I get excited. I shouldn't keep interrupting. But
oh, I love it. Keep doing it. This is great. We're having a great conversation.
Okay. That there's actually evidence showing that imagined exercise actually has the same effect as, let's say, real exercise. So now you're in a cast, or you're dying, you just don't have the energy to go to the gym or do something. You know, imagine yourself doing it. And I do that every morning. You know, my spouse does yoga and I watch meaningfully.
Yeah,
and
I love
my balance is just as good.
Yeah, I mean, and what you're saying, I mean, that's, I see this all the time. I mean, in my own work, like, I've helped women from ages 28 to 52 beat the odds. I mean, some with horrific statistics that they were looking at, but at the through line is exactly what you're talking about. Like, if I was going to, you know, summarize that, it really is mindfulness. It's this willingness to make mistakes, the willingness, quote unquote mistakes, right?
Yeah. Momentary mistakes.
Yeah. And to be willing to keep doing. Because I remember from your book, this difference between try and do, they just decided that they were going to get there, that they were going to be a mom. They didn't care.
Yeah, that's something that, you know, that I hope your listeners, I hope they read the books. There's
They will, Dr. Langer, after hearing this, they're going to read it.
Lots of fun thing about language. I designed this study. We collected the data. It's all very nice. And then somebody told me, and we should call it the Yoda study, which I didn't know. You know, don't try, do. That there are words that we use that give away a feeling that we have that we might not even know. To see yourself as trying has built into it the expectation of failure. You don't try to eat an ice cream cone. You eat the ice cream. Hope is the same thing. Hope is another one of those words that sounds good. But, you know, when I get up in the morning and I go to the kitchen to get coffee, I don't hope there'll be coffee there. You know, and, you know, then another one, and take another couple of seconds for this, which I love. I had been asked to give a sermon. Now, I'm not particularly religious, and I know very little about religion, but I tend to say yes. So I say yes. Now, what am I going to talk about? This is at a Harvard church. I can't think. I think, you know, maybe forgiveness. It's not religion, but it sounds religion-like. I could get away with it. So I do a deep dive, not in what other people say, thinking about forgiveness. And I come away with something that is almost sacrilegious. So if you ask 10 people, is forgiveness good or bad? What are they going to tell you?
Probably good.
That's good. Sure. If you ask 10 people, is blame good or bad? What are they going to tell you?
Probably
it's bad. Right. But you know, you can't forgive unless you first blame. Ah, so our forgivers are our blamers. Now that's interesting. Now, do you blame people for good things or bad? You blame people for bad, but things in and of themselves are neither good nor bad. So the people who see the world negatively blame and then forgive. It sounds hardly divine, right? And that I think, you know, I have a lot in the book about people oftentimes are told by experts or figure out for themselves how to go from where they are to something better. But I'm trying to teach a better than better way. And so if you blame, surely you should forgive. It's better than not forgiving. But the whole process is unnecessary once you understand why was I gullible? Why were you, you know, obnoxious? From your perspective, there was a whole other way of viewing the situation. So there's no reason. You're not going to blame me for being trusting. And if you don't blame me for being trusting, then we don't get into whether you're going to forgive me or not. Whereas if I was gullible, you know, how could I do this to you? I mean, you just can't believe what everybody says. You know, then we're down to where eventually, you know, I persuade you there was some reason for it. And then eventually you forgive. I don't want anybody to ever forgive me of anything. I want people to understand me. And in understanding me, to know that my behavior makes sense or else I wouldn't do it, which is the same thing for everybody.
Oh, that's so beautiful, Dr. Langer. And there was a quote in your book, and it's a wonderful way for us to end this, that really moved me. And I think is it was early in the book, and you said, I live in a world of possibility, and there is always something exciting around the corner. And it just made me love you even more when I read that, because it's such a powerful thing to leave people with, that life is an adventure.
Right.
Like, be willing, you know, if you say, you know, especially for this audience, if you say that you want this baby and it feels right to you, be the woman that's willing to go the distance if that's really what you want. Like, let yourself have the experience.
But have the experience in a stress-free way.
Exactly.
Also recognizing that, you know, there's an old, it's called the Texas curse, which is I wish you what you wish for yourself. You know, the things we think we want are not necessarily going to be the best things for us. But in this case here, having a child, not having the child, taking the job, not getting the job, staying in the relationship, getting divorced, it's the wrong question that we're asking ourselves. No matter what you're doing, there's a way of doing it so that it's fulfilling and exciting. And we don't have to be victims of how other people have designed our world or, you know, our individual lives for us to take advantage of that. Women in particular need to understand that emotions are actually choices. You know, there's a tendency for people to say, you made me so angry. Nobody is making you anything. And that when you recognize that your emotions are largely a function of the way you understand the situation, if you understand the situation more mindfully, you have multiple understandings. And in doing that, you behave in a whole different way. I mean, if somebody comes over to me and they're really nice, I see them as really nice. I could see them as ingratiating. Well, if I see them as ingratiating, then I'm not going to want to reach out to them. I'm not going to have the relationship that could follow and so on. Everything can be understood in multiple ways. If one way gives you pleasure and another way makes you stressed, you know, I think choose the former.
Yeah. So much about the power of choice to choose our perspective. Yeah. And wow, that's powerful stuff, Dr. Langer. And thank you so much for spending this time with me and the listeners. We so appreciate you. We're going to have links to your book in the show notes. And I know that the women listening to this are going to devour your work just like I did. So thank you for being with us.
That was my pleasure.
Woo-wee! My loves, I hope you absolutely loved the spirited conversation that I had with the amazing Dr. Ellen Langer. Man, we just covered so much, and I hope that you were taking all of the bombs she was dropping. I mean, one of the biggest lessons that we can learn from this conversation that I had with her is that we have more license and agency and influence in our lives than we have been led to believe. And this woman, with Her decades of experience and decades of research in this area is basically standing for the proposition that you get to do your life your way. And when we put this in the context of the fertility journey, look, you have this desire. Go get it. Go get it. If this is on your heart, give yourself the experience of doing everything you possibly can that's lined up with your values. It's such a powerful thing. And I'm so grateful. And go out, get Dr. Langer's The Mindful Body, Thinking Our Way to Chronic Health. She is amazing. It's available at all bookstores and online. It'll be one of the most powerful reads that you invest your time in. And you're going to walk away really feeling energized about what's possible for you, and that knowing at your core, you aren't just a statistic. You aren't just another patient. You get to decide. And look, if you are ready to start thinking, believing, and taking action like a woman who succeeds on her fertility journey, which is my area of expertise, my Fearlessly Fertile Method program is for women who intend to get pregnant in the next 12 months and say hell yes to covering their bases, mind, and body. Go to my website, www.frommaybetobaby.com, and apply for an interview there. My methodology has helped women around the world make their mom dreams come true. Their results speak for themselves. And look, if you don't have a mindset for success in this journey, baby, what are you doing? Let me help you fix that shit and set you up for success. Till next time, change your mindset. Change your results.
Love this episode of the Fearlessly Fertile podcast? Subscribe now and leave an awesome review. Remember, the desire in your heart to be a mom is there because it was meant for you. When it comes to your dreams, keep saying hell yes.